Thanks, Andy. I suppose when people start walking out, I will start. I always like people to interrupt me when I give a talk, and even more so when it's a lecture, because I think otherwise it will be boring for everybody, including myself. So whenever you think I'm going too fast or there's something not clear, please just jump in and ask, and that's what I really would appreciate. So the topic of the lecture is optimal control of open quantum systems. Let me see how high I can get it. And let me, usually I'm not even little in the US, right? That's one of the things I enjoy. In Germany, I'm always on the short side. Anyway, so let's start with a definition, because control means many things to many people. So when I speak of control, what I mean is that we want to steer a dynamical system. And in our case, it will be, of course, an open quantum system, and we want to steer it in the desired way. So, what does this mean if we picture, right? So let's say this is our state space, which is the space of the density matrices defined on our Hilbert space, and let's assume that this is our initial state. So we have some rho at time equals zero, and then we want to go to some target state, whatever it may be. So we're seeking the time evolution, the dynamical map, that takes me from rho at time zero to rho at time t, which is the desired target state. And at this point, I'm not making any assumptions except that I'm able to calculate d, which of course is kind of a constraint. But other than that, whether it's Markovian, non-Markovian, doesn't matter so far, as long as I'm able to calculate d. And before I continue, there's another disclaimer, because now I'm looking for classical external fields that produce me the desired time evolution. So when people speak about optimal control theory, typically there's no measurement, no feedback. So there's what's in the mathematical control theory community, at least, is called open loop in our case, whereas if you use measurement and feedback, it would be closed loop. Okay, so we are looking for external classical fields and that in physics typically are electric fields, magnetic fields, so let's just use the mathematical notation for a moment. And then in the mathematical control literature, this is typically called U. And if we have a vectorial field, then we have several components U of L. So these are our controls. And again, this is my disclaimer, because this is often, when you speak about quantum control, something that confuses people, that they assume that you're also talking about feedback. So I'm not speaking about feedback. Whereas in our case, it would be called open loop, because you're calculating with the optimal control theory the shape of these time-dependent controls, and then you try them in the experiment. So you I mean, in the end, of course, you close the loop. If something doesn't work, you have to go back to the drawing board. But you're not doing a feedback loop. Okay, so then let's come to the next really important question. So why are we interested in the control of open quantum systems? And now we are here at KITP, right? So I don't have you to give my typical selling lecture that we are interested in quantum technologies and everything. Every quantum system is open and we need to worry about this. So let's ask this question from a different perspective, from a theory perspective. Why is it a genuinely interesting problem? Okay, so let me again draw a little scheme. So let's say this, we have a system or a quantum system. Let's make this more colorful. And our system interacts with the environment. Okay, whatever. So the box is our environment. And now, I would say, by definition, controls act only on the system. Okay, so I have some U of T, L of T, a set of them, doesn't matter. So you're by that? No objections? Of course, the point I'm trying to make is that what I call system and what I call environment is my decision. And there's not a clear-cut recipe for this. So I'm suggesting that if I can access a degree of freedom directly by coupling it to an external field, then it has to be part of my system. Whereas environmental degrees, by definition, are those that I cannot directly control. It doesn't mean that I cannot control them at all, because I still have the coupling between the system and the environment. Right, so I may be able, and this is something that, for example, right now, you may have seen for NV centers that you can use the electron spin to polarize the nuclear spins, whereas the nuclear spins typically are considered the bath. So you can control the environment, but not directly. Okay, so that's the framework into which I want to put myself. And if you agree with this definition, then there are many open questions beyond just getting things to work. So, first of all, what are viable control strategies given that they have this coupling between system and environment? And of course, this is not something that I have started to think about yesterday and nobody else has thought about. There is a long history, and some control strategies exist already, but I would say that the general picture is still fairly scattered. So if you just think, like, broadly, what kind of strategies can there be? So what you often hear is that you can have these two extreme cases of, on one hand, trying to fight the environment or avoid the coupling with the environment. And this is something that you can do, for example, by just being fast. And that's one of the main reasons why people have started to look at optimal control theory for open quantum systems, because you don't need to be adiabatic to do something with high fidelity. You can do things fast. So just to beat decoherence. Or another very popular concept that I would consider under the big framework of avoiding or fighting the environment is dynamical decoupling, where you kick the system so quickly that effectively you decouple it from the environment. But this is not the only option. We can, of course, also say, well, if you can't beat your enemy, make him your friend or her. And this is not necessarily only something you want to do, but sometimes you have to do it. Why? Why? Maybe you have to exploit or use the environment. Come on.
Is it a question? I can't tell the way.
It's a question. Okay. Yes, sorry. What do you think? Why? What are examples where you need the environment?
Maybe you're trying to do some sort of dissipative state preparation. You're actually doing some sort of mini-body laser cooling or something like that, and the dissipation is doing part of what you want, and then you have something adiabatic that goes with that.
Exactly. So the keyword I was looking for is cooling, because in cooling you need dissipation, because you need to change the entropy of your system. Okay, so you can't do this with just coherent evolution, and then you need the environment. And you can view this as a way to exploit that there is an environment.
I mean, anytime you want to move entanglement in and out of your system, or, you know, you can use the environment to think about doing that, right, in some fashion.
For entanglement, it's an option, uh-huh. But it's not necessary. Okay. If you want to change the entropy of your system, it's a necessity.
Right. So you really... Classical entropy, you mean?
Yes.
Not one.
Okay, and then you could think of what could be control schemes. Well, you could, for example, ask, can I enhance cooling rates? Or, I mean, this relates to Lincoln's suggestion, there may be control schemes that use the environment, so can I identify control mechanisms which rely on the coupling with the environment? So environment-induced controls, I would call them, or enabled. Okay, and then I'm a little surprised that Hans-Peter is so quiet, because there's a very obvious framework of thinking that is still missing here, which is quantum reservoir engineering. Okay. That, of course, also falls under this umbrella of exploiting the environment. And again, you can combine this now with control and ask, well, if people can come up with schemes for quantum reservoir engineering, can I either make them better? And the answer is yes. Or can I maybe find schemes that you couldn't just think up because the system is becoming too complex for that? And that's an open question. So we actually have an example from my group where I thought we found something that nobody had seen before. And then we spoke to people and they had still come up with it on paper. So. But I think I'm optimistic that eventually there's room for improvement. Okay, so this is the first set of open questions. What are, for open quantum systems, what are viable control strategies? The next question, which is closely related, is how do these strategies depend on the environment, on the time scale of the environment, and on the coupling? So the dependence on the properties of the environment or the coupling. And finally, if I'm really ambitious and brave, I can ask, is it possible to identify fundamental limits to control? on a general level. Okay, and if you speak to people who come from control theory, or even from quantum control theory, then you may notice that there are two basic questions that people are interested in. And this is the question of, can I reach a control target? Yes or no? Which is what is termed controllability. And the other question is, either I know that I can reach it, or I just assume I can. How do I get there? So that I would call control synthesis. So controllability means, can a target be reached? And the answer is a yes or no answer. And control synthesis tells me how to reach a target. And the answer is the shape of your controls. Okay. Now this is true in general. If you look at open quantum systems, and let's first focus on controllability, what is the status there? So for closed quantum systems, controllability is, from the mathematical point of view, a solved problem. And I'll give you a brief outline of what is the tool and why is it so nice, but why can it not be extended easily to open quantum systems? So I would say, I know what to do, it's okay. Now for open quantum systems, you have to distinguish between those with Markovian dynamics and those with non-Markovian dynamics. So let's start with the Markovian case. There, a few things are known, there are a few results, but there's no complete picture, so I would say it's kind of neutral. Whereas for systems with non-Markovian dynamics, there's really nothing known, I mean zero. Of course, now you could also argue that you can reverse emojis, because it's good if there is work to be done, and I should be happy about the last point and not the first. Okay, so let me give you a brief outline of controllability theory for closed quantum systems. And typically, you make in controllability theory, you always make one assumption, because in the end, you're asking really just, in principle, can I reach a target, yes or no? So you assume infinite resources. So even if, in principle, you can reach it, you may still not be able to reach it in an actual experiment. But that's kind of a secondary question. Let's say we assume sufficient resources. Doesn't mean they have to be infinite. So what do I mean by sufficient resources? Can be power of your fields or the time that it takes you to reach the target. Doesn't matter. Okay, we assume that we have those. And then for a closed quantum system, our equation of motion is the Schrödinger equation. And what you do in control theory is that you write your Hamiltonian into a field-free part, and in the literature, this is called the drift, which I think is mainly because much of this has been done first for NMR systems. And the ULs are our controls. And the VLs are the coupling operators. So this would typically be a dipole moments or higher order couplings. Depends on your physical system. Okay, now for simplicity. So this is a basic assumption that you always make in order to get this yes or no answer. Just to simplify my notation, and this is not crucial, you can generalize the argument beyond these assumptions. Let's assume that we have piecewise constant controls. What do I mean by this? Well, if this is time and this is my u of t, I assume that I can discretize time, and then within certain time steps, my field can look, have some really funny shape, but it's piecewise constant. Okay. And again, just to save me things to write, let's assume there's only a single u. U of t, v. Okay, now, with this assumption of piecewise constant controls within each of these time steps, I can formally solve the Schrödinger equation without having to worry about time ordering. So I can write my wave function at time t as exponent of h0 plus uv, wave function at time zero. Okay, and now you remember our basic quantum mechanics and how to expand these exponents. And what happens if you expand these exponents, then you get nested commutators. And that's not like we most of the time do in undergraduate lectures, like cut this after the second term, but let's include higher order terms as well. So we have h0, uv, this is my first order term, then I get the second order term, which involves the commutator. Oh, I have to be sure not to mix up signs. If I go to third order, and don't worry, I will stop there, because this is enough to give you the idea. I have to consider two terms. Namely, once I have the nested commutator of h0 with the second order commutator, and I have the nested commutator of v. And then I can go to even higher order nested commutators. So this is what is called in the literature the Magnus expansion. Of course, you can use other expansions, but what always happens is that you'll have the Hamiltonian, the drift, the field-free one, and these coupling operators, and then commutators of the two, and higher order commutators of the two. Now, what does this mean? If I have something that is exponent and then applied to my wave function, sorry, this would of course be zero. These are, and that's of course something that you know, the generators of the evolution. Okay, now let's combine this with a geometrical picture. So we have our state, that we can always visualize as a Bloch vector. Okay, so what is then the meaning, if we think in the Bloch sphere representation, what is the meaning of these commutators, these operators? In principle, it's always, this is an operator, and this again gives me an operator. Okay, so I have several operators showing up there.
Are you again asking a question? It's
I am asking a question, yes. I think I'm too German. The question is, if you think of the wave function at the beginning as a Bloch vector, then in this geometrical picture, what is the role of the generators?
They tell you the axes around which you're rotating.
They tell me the axes.
So these are going to be rotations in the Bloch sphere, and if you have generators in the simplest cases, then they're going to tell you essentially around which axis you're rotating.
So this is, you can think of this as a rotation. But if, let's make it infinitesimal, I think it makes it even more intuitive. So maybe Walter had a.
I thought about rotations as well.
Okay, so rotations is okay. What I want to get at is that these will give me the directions, okay, in my evolution. So these are, like, if this is the Bloch vector, then these are the tangent vectors on the Bloch sphere. And they give me the directions for the time evolution, which is rotation, yes, of course.
It's a specification, an
axis of rotation. Yeah. It's the same. Okay, so we have the generators of the evolution are all of these operators. H0, V, the first commutator. The second one, and so on. Okay, so now I can ask my question again. What does it mean for a quantum system to be controllable? In other words, to implement any time evolution. That's another way to pose it. And this is again a question, Lincoln.
Thank you.
You need essentially a complete set of linearly independent directions that you can move.
Exactly. So controllability is connected to the number of generators that I have. And these generators form a Lie algebra because my unitary time evolution forms a Lie group. So one way to phrase controllability is to ask, is my Lie algebra of full rank? Okay, so. So what happens if a system is not controllable? Well, if you calculate these commutators, at some point you get back operators which you have already in your list. And then you have to count how many of those you have. And if your Hilbert space is n-dimensional, you need n squared minus 1 if you take out the global phase elements in your Lie algebra.
Super naive question. So you talk about the Bloch sphere, but you have more than two dimensions, right?
I'll show you how to go to Bloch sphere in many dimensions in a few minutes.
Okay.
But you can, it's a picture that for any n-level system, you can define a Bloch vector. So it has to be finite dimensional, of course, otherwise it's. But let's assume that for the time being. In physics, anything is finite dimensional, I argue. Infinity is something that mathematicians invented to make our life miserable.
Oh. It's easier to do integrals than sums, so. Right?
Maybe there's a trade-off. You're right. Okay, so let me just tell you, this is still not the complete picture, but we're almost there. So here you could argue, well, this I can now tell yes and no, but doesn't it depend on the initial state? And the answer is no. Why? Because this equation of motion is, of course, also applicable to the unitary time evolution operator. So I can do the same analysis. I can write my unitary evolution, and I'm now asking, can I generate any unitary time evolution? I can write as an E times C. Did I keep the time? Yes. No I here. EC. And I can expand this into a basis of skew Hermitian matrices. And then I'm back to the same picture, and I just have to ask, do I have enough of those linearly independent skew Hermitian matrices?
Sorry, may I ask what that is? What is a skew Hermitian matrix?
So it's a Hermitian, you know? And
yes, I know.
Skew is just that you... what is the symmetry property that was there?
It's minuses. That's on Hermitian conjugate.
Exactly. But the main point is that, okay, going from here to there, there's nothing new. It's the same argument. Okay, just a different a little bit more complex mathematical expression. Okay, so full controllability means all n squared generators are good. Okay, so and that's what's called the full rank condition. So dimension of the D algebra should be n squared. What does this mean if I have a symmetry in my system? Is it controllable or not? It's not. Why?
You're missing one direction. You can never go off to the symmetry.
Exactly. Okay, so if I have a symmetry, my Hilbert space is falling into two subspaces, and then maybe within each subspace I can have full controllability, but not in between the two. So symmetry is the enemy of controllability. Hmm. Okay. This is a very nice mathematical theory, and it relies on the group properties of unitary evolution, and therefore we cannot use it as is for open quantum systems. Yes.
I mean, you mean symmetry of the Hamiltonian including your control piece, because if you break the symmetry with the control piece, your symmetry is gone and you can control on
yes.
it.
Yes, so of course I'm always speaking about this Hamiltonian.
Okay, so it's just that your fields are limited. Because you, I mean, if you are going to a symmetric subspace, it means that your fields do not break the symmetry sufficiently.
Yeah, but if you have something like parity, for example, it's maybe hard to break with an external field.
It may be hard, but it's I just want to understand what you're saying.
Yes.
If you are limited in your field and you don't have the infinite resources, okay, then it makes sense.
In any case, so this is a very nice theory that goes back to the 1970s. And, of course, it may be difficult to apply if your system becomes too large because you have to generate the Lie algebra of an n-level system. But, in principle, you know what to do. Unfortunately, there's no simple way to extend it to open quantum systems. So what can you do then? And there are two options. And I think one is fairly well established and the other one is still in its infancy. So let's look at the extension. And let's first look at Markovian dynamics. So we assume that we have a master equation that describes our dynamics with constant rates. That's the second assumption. So only for that part of Markovian evolutions, there exists some controllability analysis. Now our equation of motion is, and I always mix up signs, so we assume that in our dissipator we have constant rates that multiply our Lindblad operators, and we also assume that, which I think is in a way inherent of the Markov assumption, although not everybody is aware of that, that our controls do not change the dissipator. Okay, and the work that I'm briefly referring to right now is nothing that I have done, but it has been pioneered by an Italian mathematical physicist named Claudio Altafini, and there exists also a very nice review by Dirk Helmke, some complicated name, and another complicated name, but I know it because it's German, so Schulte Herr Brüggen. In Reports of Mathematical Physics. And essentially you have to distinguish again between two cases. So one is that your dissipator does not generate any new directions in the dynamics. Or in other words, it's proportional to the identity. What does this mean? Well, if we again use our Bloch's field picture, and now say that we have some initial state here, and if we had unitary evolution, then the state would somehow go around on this Bloch sphere. And what happens now in the case of this type of dissipation is that it pulls this towards the origin. And that tells you what states are accessible for this evolution. If this is my coherent evolution, so this would be the action of the adjoint of the group SUN. So here's where the group property of unitary evolution comes in. And then the dissipation does nothing but to pull me inside. The other case is that you have a generic dissipator. And in that case, the dissipation itself can generate new directions for the dynamics. And then the picture becomes a bit more complicated. So if we start here and have unitary evolution, it does not just pull in, it can also generate new directions, and this would be the accessible state. So this is just a geometrical illustration of the result of these people to give you a flavor. What I want to show you with this is that in principle, under these assumptions, the controllability problem also has been solved. But now you could argue, well, these are the boring cases of open quantum systems. Right, so for, where do I write this? I don't want to start a new table. If you have time-dependent rates, then you cannot apply this picture. So what essentially, what mathematically what they did is, instead of having a Lie algebra, the dissipation now defines a Lie wedge. You have to go into this if you're interested in the details.
Did you say a Lie wedge?
A Lie wedge, yes. Okay, but more in general, which means Markovian evolutions with time-dependent rates or non-Markovian evolution, the question of controllability is an open field, so there's a big question mark. That people have just very recently started to think about. And the keyword here that you want to use is, so you cannot do, obviously, if you want to get meaningful results, you cannot do anymore this yes-no answer. Okay, so first of all, you should be happy with just coming close to your target within a certain environment of size epsilon. So that is what approximate controllability analysis does. And maybe you should also introduce time into the controllability analysis. Because obviously for non-Markovian systems, these are all statements about, in the end, about steady states. But you may not necessarily be interested in steady states. Okay, and then this approach is not what you're after. Whereas this approximate controllability could maybe be more useful. But again, this is a really open question, and if you're interested in more details, then that's certainly something to talk about. Do you have any more questions on controllability? Because if not, I would move to control synthesis. Yes, you do. No?
Maybe just to get an idea, like how many systems are actually Markovian and how many are non-Markovian?
I think there are other people here in the audience who can tell you much more about it. As a rule of thumb, so quantum optics is typically Markovian because spontaneous emission, whereas condensed phase is typically non-Markovian as a rule of thumb.
Okay.
You want
to? Yeah, a similar remark. I mean, this distinction of Markovian and non-Markovian is rather dangerous, I think, as soon as you allow, say, for control fields that are fast.
Of course.
Of course, the fundamental assumption in the Markov approximation is that everything is slow.
I completely
and
agree.
It's entirely not consistent to use fast fields, for instance, in a Markov frame. Within the assumptions that you have made to actually arrive at the Markov evolution. So I think the two should not be considered separate. They are somehow, you have to look at them from a non-Markovian, from a general point of view, and then check in the end whether you're still within the Markov assumption.
Well,
depends on all kinds of things. But generally speaking, I would say it's not so clear that a Markov control is actually the generic.
No, it's not the generic. I absolutely agree. But I would say still, you can do optimal, or you can derive fast controls in quantum optical systems, and it's perfectly fine. And I think that's maybe for intuitive answer.
Yeah.
A starting point.
Yeah.
But yes, the generic case is the one that we don't know too much.
The problem is that fast is an undefined term. But I think the point you make is very important, that you check afterwards whether you are still in this regime or not.
But I think we'll have another lecture on how to solve non-Markovian dynamics. So from my point of view, I just assume that I can do it. Okay, and there are a few people around here who have their own flavors of methods. And we have our own, of course, too. So let's assume we can do it and just come back to this picture of our state space. So we're looking for a dynamical map, and as I said, we assume that we can. We can calculate it, because that's a prerequisite for control theory. Okay, so now the title of my lecture is Optimal Control. Question is, what do we mean by optimal? Now I cannot ask implicit questions anymore.
You want to set a certain set of constraints that probably has something to do with the physical system, like sort of the frequencies at which you can control things, and then ask for the control fields that give you the highest fidelity for the state you're trying to repair or something like that.
Exactly. Very good. So the point is, or the more mathematical expression for this is, we want to reach the target with the minimum expenditure of effort, or of resources. And that translates into constraints. So this may be, again, power or time. You can look for time optimal solutions and so on. Okay.
How would you define this, say, if you cannot reach the state at the end, but only to a certain fidelity, would you always say the best is to reach the fidelity or like a less, or have it anyway as fast as possible, but with
so
less
fidelity? You're directly hinting at my next question. So the starting point of any optimal control consideration is, how do I quantify success? And you already mentioned fidelity, so obviously I need some figure of merit. So fidelity for state preparation is 1. So let's just look at an example that may look very reasonable to you. So let's say what we do is we match the evolutions, let's just write it. So at the final time t, I want my propagated state, so my rho at final time, to perfectly overlap with the target state. That would be described by a Hilbert-Schmidt product, because my rho's are Hermitian, I can leave out the Hermitian conjugate. I take here 1 minus, that will be an error. So I have, because I like to minimize, but that's just a matter of convenience. We could also as well maximize this. Okay, so you can think of this, if you're not familiar with this language of Hilbert-Schmidt products, that this is the generalization of the Hilbert space scalar product to density matrices, or to operators in general. Okay, so this looks good, doesn't it? Well, it's okay if your target state is real. Not real, it is pure. Real doesn't make sense, of course. But it may fail. If your target state is mixed. So already, when you look for how to quantify success, you have to be careful. Now you can ask, well, when do I have a mixed target state? Why would I be interested in it? Well, it's certainly not the standard control application, but you can think of squeezing. Many squeezing experiments, you don't reach a pure state. In fact, you have a trade-off between purity and squeezing. So maybe you want a mixed state, which has the maximum squeezing. And then this matters. So what you do in control is that you treat this as a functional of the field. And in view of time, I think I'm going to skip a little bit on the details. So why does this fail for a mixed state? The answer is, again, in the Bloch sphere picture. I will give you the parametrization, though, because I think you asked for it. So in general, you can where the AKs are just a traceless Hermitian complete basis. And then this R is your Bloch vector. Okay, so you can keep this whole nice geometrical picture also if you have a system larger than n equals 2. So the intuition why this fails if your target state is mixed is that this overlap only maximizes the angle of your Bloch vector. So it makes sure that the angle of the Bloch vector is aligned with your target vector. But it does not match the length. And that also explains why it works for pure states, and length is 1, and it fails for mixed states. Okay, so what are the requirements for a target functional that you want? So besides capturing the physics that you're actually after, it should be real valued, so that you can minimize it or maximize it. And it should take its extremum if and only if you are at the desired state. That's the general conditions. And then in addition, if you want to use a gradient-based optimization method, it should also be continuously differentiable. And then if you are a quantum information theorist, you may have wondered from the first point, why are you using here an overlap and not a distance measure? Okay, so there are a number of distance measures, but most of them are not continuously differentiable. And that's a problem in optimization.
Can I ask a question? So if you want to use your target state for something, I mean, is there optimization in terms of optimizing some quantity associated with the state? Like, that's something I've been looking at. We can look at an overlap of a state after some evolution. And it's not very good, but actually we quantify it with some quantum Fisher information. And actually that does much better than the fidelity. So,
in this case, quantum Fisher information you can also use. As an optimization functional, yes.
But yeah, it seems sometimes there can be quantities which if you want to use that target state for some specific.
It's a very good remark, and I'll get back to this in a minute, because it's really important that you realize you don't need a distance measure here, because all that matters in the end is the direction, that you go to the right place. Okay. You can still use a distance measure afterwards to evaluate your actual fidelity, but for the optimization itself, what matters is the direction. But if you're not really interested in one specific state, but one specific property, you better optimize this property and not the state. That's exactly an important point. So, that brings me exactly to this point, that how do you choose the optimization function? And And what you should do, and it sounds very easy, but it may not be, is that it really should encode all the desired physics except for the equations of motion that you can introduce. You can also include them as with the Lagrange multiplier, but you can also introduce them by hand. So what do I mean by that? Well, we go back to our idea here that we have also additional constraints. So we have a functional of the yet unknown controls that include my final time target and additional constraints that may depend on time. So this is final time, this is intermediate time. And constraint is one option. So for example, you can say, whenever I update my control, I want the increase in power to be minimal. Okay, that would be the following form that you say you can even have a shape in addition, u squared minus some reference. So this would make sure that with respect to the reference field, you change as little as possible. And if you take the reference field, the field from the previous iteration step, then it would be the change in power every time you update your field. But that's not the only option. So this term may also depend on the state itself. And one reason to do this is if you have a time-dependent target. For example, you want to follow a certain trajectory in quotation marks, or you want to optimize a time-dependent expectation value of some operator, A. What could this be? Well, you could want to minimize the energy along the dynamics or the entropy. Or you could maximize squeezing, if that's what you were after. Okay. So. Okay, now the important point is that this is all the information about the physics that you will give to the numerical methods. And the numerical method gives you the answer to what you're asking, which is to find an extremum of this functional. So if you don't get the answer that you're expecting, maybe you haven't asked the question that you were thinking to ask. Okay, so if, for example, I use this constraint, what will very often happen is that I get controls which are spectrally extremely broad. And now you may say, well, that's I blame the optimization algorithm. No. You didn't ask for the spectral bandwidth to be minimized. Okay, so if you have a restriction on bandwidth, you better include it here. So this is what I mean with you have to encode all the physics that is relevant for a given problem. Okay, so one example which I want to go into with a bit of more time, because it may be one of the important ones, is that if we want to optimize for a certain quantum operation or quantum gate, how do I do that?
Maybe just one question. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the choice of your optimization function, you could also take the square. So why is it a natural, is there some natural choices to choose or some optimal choices? Because you could of an expression which you have defined, you could just take the square or some other function of it, or you could take the square first and then subtract the other parts. So why?
The square, like here, you mean?
No, you square, for example, the first part, the overlap before.
You can do that, yes.
So why is there an intrinsic choice what one have to choose, or why do I have? Why is this form optimal?
The in the end, it doesn't matter. So it you should be careful because you have. I should have maybe here I put the weight, right? So you still have optimization weights that you give relative to your different terms in the functional.
But you could also square them or take a function like a.
So the square you don't.
Just if you try to make a fit, I can trade the one norm, I can take the two norm, I can take the p norm. So.
Well, again, you want it to be continuously differentiable. That already excludes some of them. And you don't want to go to very high power also. Why? Because you're starting with a guess field. I mean, these optimizations all work iteratively. And then you evaluate the functional. And this tells you how to change your field. So if you use a high power in this overlap, for example, then this number will be very small, and it just numerically is not very stable. But there's no intrinsic reason. It's more a technical reason. Okay, so what do we have to do if we want to optimize for a quantum gate? So I started all of this with the overlap of states. So for closed quantum systems, the overlap of the state is I have a target state and I have my propagated state, and I make it real by either taking the real part or by taking the square modulus. That is my choice. Now, one way to generalize this to a quantum gate is to say, okay, now if I want to implement a quantum gate, I have to do this for any state in my basis. Okay, so I just have to expand this, or choose an expansion of Hilbert space in a complete orthonormal basis, and the dimension of the Hilbert space in that case is given by the dimension of the gate. So for a 1-qubit gate, it's just 2. I have 2 states. For a 2-qubit gate, it will be 4. I have 4 states, and so on. Okay, so one way to go to a gate is to say this will be minus. And then I have my target operation and my actual evolution. Okay, so I'm matching, again, just like here, I was matching my actual evolution, my desired evolution. Now I'm matching my actual evolution to my desired evolution. And if I expand the trace, I'll get exactly this, that I have several of those overlaps. And if my actual evolution happens in a Hilbert space which is larger than the target space, then I have to project it down. Okay, so that would be. So let's say for an atom, it's typically not 2 levels, so I have an n-level atom, but I want a single qubit gate, then I have to project down into the logical subspace. Now, if we want to go to open quantum systems, what do you think you have to do? Or what would be one option to do?
Within Markov or not?
Doesn't matter. I'm just assuming that I have time evolution, dynamical map.
Your dynamical map will then be specified, for example, by some set of cross operators, and you could look at some sort of increase fidelity of what you get out to the cross operators?
You don't even have to go to be so specific. I mean, the simplest brute force way would be to say, okay, this is defined for operators on Hilbert space. Let's just lift it to Liouville space. Okay. So here I expand into a basis of Hilbert space cats, and now I expand into a basis of density operators. So I have my desired evolution, which is given by my target, applied onto my initial state, and then I have the actual time evolution of my initial state, which is described by this dynamical map, and I have to do this for a complete basis. Okay, but that's okay, but it's a complete overkill. So this, again, is a desired evolution, and this is the actual why? What you're not taking into account in this expression is that you're not interested in optimizing some general open system evolution. You want the evolution to be unitary. So you don't need all the information that you need to describe a full open quantum system process. Okay, then the question is, well, how much information do you need? I'm claiming I don't need n squared. I'm asking how many do I need? Now you may have a guess. Come on, be bold. This just has to be a guess.
I mean, in tensor network methods, we're able to optimize the vectors in Hilbert space that we need, and you can similarly optimize, you know, with another index, which essentially gets you to Liouville space, right? So, I don't know if that's the way that you go, but I mean, there you do order by singular values. So you need, depending on the kind of system you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
100, maybe, definitely not.
Okay. Another guess?
N.
So surprisingly, if you just want the yes-no answer, you need 3.
3?
Yes. Okay. Also, N is a better choice numerically. But why do you need 3? I think it's a very nice answer. You need 2 to differentiate any 2 unitaries. And then another one to check how non-unitary you are.
I'm sorry, Christiana, have you assumed some knowledge about the basis to use these 3?
I will just go into it.
Okay.
So, okay, so let's first focus on why you need 2 to differentiate any 2 unitaries. And for this, we can consider coherent time evolution. So what I'm asking is, I want to map U onto a set of density operators and I want to know how many of these rows do I need to make this map injective. So first, why do I need more than one? Well, because if I have one, it may be that row, this one row has this, a common eigenbasis with my U. And then I can exchange the order here and I just get identity. Okay, so I can, or actually I should step back and say, differentiating U and U prime is the same as differentiating any U from identity because of the group property. It's just the global phase that I have in going from U to PU, projective unitary group. Okay, so I need to ask, what do I need to differentiate U from identity? So a single row is not enough because it may have a common eigenbasis with U and then I can't distinguish it from identity. So I need at least two. And now the question, of course, is why is two enough? So I can first construct one state to fix the basis. And the way I do this is I say I have one-dimensional projectors in my Hilbert space. And I use those to construct my rule. So the PIs are one-dimensional orthogonal projectors. And the lambdas are taken to be pairwise different. So I can think of this row as looking into any direction of my Hilbert space with a different lambda. And that's why I know in which direction I'm looking. Okay? And now I need a second state where I can be sure that this second state has no common eigenspace with any of those projectors. So how do I do this? Well, I use again just a one-dimensional projector, but I take it in such a way that it is rotated with respect to all of these PIs. So we call it totally rotated, and this means that it's not orthogonal to any of those. Now, this may sound familiar to some of you, maybe not in this language of projectors, but this idea of being rotated is nothing else but what is used in mutually unbiased spaces. Except that here we need only one of these basis vectors from the mutually unbiased spaces. And not all of them. Okay, and then one can prove, and I won't give you the proof here, but you can read it up if you're interested or talk to me. About it, that these two states are sufficient to distinguish any U from U prime. Okay, and then what I need is the third state to check unitality, and that's actually very simple. That is enough to see whether identity is mapped onto identity. And then, instead of having this functional with having to propagate n squared different states, in principle, it is sufficient to have here these three states. And again, the intuition is that what I'm interested in is the unitary time evolution, not the total open system evolution. So I don't care what are the specific dissipative processes. And it turned out, so this is what got us, this optimal control question got us there. But of course, these ideas of having these few states, reduced set of states, can also be used for process characterization if you want to estimate the fidelity of a quantum gate. Okay, and then just the last remark, which relates to Scott's question. So you may not necessarily want to optimize for a specific state, but rather for an expectation value or another property. And similarly here, what I've shown you so far is you know your target gate. But for example, if you're interested in a universal set of gates, then you know you need a specific set of single qubit gates and one entangling gate. But you don't necessarily care which one. And you don't necessarily know which one is best. So for quantum optical systems, typically you do know, but in superconducting qubits, for example, you have a large choice, and you don't know a priori which one is the easiest or the fastest to implement. And then you can use also these similar ideas and say, well, let's not write an optimization functional where we look for a specific gate, but let's optimize for a specific kind of entanglement or for a specific or for an arbitrary perfect entangler. That's also possible. Okay, so that's and again, in view of time, I'm just telling you this can be done, and if you're interested, we can talk about it. Okay, so I think I'm going to skip about numerical methods just to tell you that there are some that use the gradient of this functional or that use only the functional. So gradient free and gradient based. What do you do? Well, in gradient free methods, you just parameterize your control little u in a specific basis, like Fourier components, whatever. And then you have the Fourier amplitudes and frequencies, and you optimize them with some nonlinear optimization method. You can use Neldermeade, you can use something more sophisticated. There are many methods available out there. Okay. This is the nice thing of these methods, of these gradient-free methods, is that they're searching your search space globally. So if you find an optimal, you can be sure it's a global optimal. You hardly do find any, though, because these methods tend to get stuck. And the more parameters you have, the more easily they get stuck. So if you have more than, let's say, 10 or 20 optimization parameters, you're most likely won't be successful. Which is why people have focused on gradient-based methods, where you look at the gradient of this functional. Or in other words, you use variational calculus and ask for an extremum of this J. And this is equivalent to the so-called Pontryagin maximum principle, these gradient-based methods. And then if you, so you're asking with respect to, so you want this total J to have an extremum. And that translates into variation with respect to the control, but also variation with respect to the state. And when you take the variation with respect to the states, then you get an equation that starts from your target and goes backwards. So the hallmark of all gradient-based methods is that you need to be able to propagate your system both forward and backward, which for open quantum systems can be tricky. No, I mean, just in terms of numerical stability. But these methods have really very nice convergence properties, and you can also not just include the gradient, but also go to higher order derivatives. Okay. And again, unless you want to use those tomorrow, I think this information is not so super relevant, so I want to use the last couple of minutes to give you a bit of an overview of what kind of problems can we solve and what kind of problems have we in my group looked at. And again, I'm just giving you a flavor, and if you're interested, then we can talk about it in more detail. And again, as a general rule, so the basic requirement is that you need to be able to calculate the time evolution. And these numerical methods that now I skipped over are iterative, so you need to do this at least about 100 times. Okay, so if you do this numerically, it means that if already a single propagation takes a day, then you probably don't think about using optimal control. If it takes an hour or two, then it's still okay. So.
For the lifetime of the PhD student. Or the number of computers you have in parallel.
It's just something to keep in mind. I mean, that's a optimization is on top of your actual solving the equations of motion. Okay, so one example I already mentioned, we determined the fastest universal set of gates. For transmon qubits. Using this formalism of gate optimization for the single qubit gates, and then to optimizing for an arbitrary perfect entangler for the entangling gate. And we did this in the presence of T1 and T2 decay or processes. And the control strategy I already wrote here fastest in that case is really just to beat decoherence, to be as fast as possible, and then you can show that you get fidelities which are only limited by the background lifetimes of your qubits and cavity in that case. What was one point that I want to highlight here is that we did this over the complete design parameter space. So if you have heard about transmon qubits a little bit, then you know these are engineered systems, so it's up to you to choose what is the qubit frequency, what is the cavity frequency which you couple to the qubit, and how strong is the coupling. I mean, of course you can vary them only in certain range, but the range is quite significant, and it's not a priori clear what is the best choice of these parameters. And so far people have mainly use the dispersive regime where your coupling to the cavity is very weak and you can integrate it out and have a nice just two-qubit system. And what we found is that what we call the quad-disk regime, so quasi-dispersive straddling qubits, is the optimal regime where you get the fastest operation. So you don't want to be in the dispersive limit, you don't want to be in a strong coupling limit. Intuitively, that's clear because you want to be able to both implement single-qubit gates and two-qubit gates. Okay, and then the S here stands for straddling, so you really use interference between the different qubit levels to implement all the desired evolutions. But in view of controlling an open quantum system, this means you beat decoherence. Then we looked at the fastest reset, so qubit reset, and this is a nice problem, so it's a bit, not a very complex description of the system. So we have our qubit, and this is coupled to some ancilla, and this is coupled to a thermal reservoir. So in principle, this is our bath. And here, of course, you have to be sure that your coupling is not, your drive on the qubit is not too strong, not too, to violate the assumptions that you're making when you derive the master equation for the reservoir. But you can boil this down to something that you can actually solve analytically with the variational calculus ideas, and you can show that sigma z control on the qubit is optimal. The reset time is given by the coupling with this ancilla, or 1 over the coupling. And what was the most interesting finding here is that if you have initial correlations between system and bath, in our case between the ancilla and this two-level and the qubit, then the reset time becomes shorter and your error becomes smaller. But you have to know what are these correlations. Okay, so that's a teaser for people who are interested in initial correlations. We also, and this is something I mentioned in the beginning, we showed that you can use optimal control to improve quantum reservoir engineering. So we looked at an experiment that had been done in NIST and Dave Winans' group, where they used dissipation to drive into an entangled state of two ions. And they could do this with a fidelity of something like 75%. And the reason was that in this experiment, the steady state was not really the target state of the evolution, of the state preparation. So when you use optimal control, first thing that you see is, well, actually, just by choosing the polarizations that they used in the experiment better, you can reduce the undesired loss processes, which are always also there. And then you increase your fidelity from 75 to something like almost 90%, still a 10% error. And the reason, again, is that the steady state was not the actual target state. So then we went one step further and said, well, now we can use optimal control to tell us what are the coupling operators that we need, what are the effective dissipators that really give us the target state. And we found a scheme that the NIST people are now really interested in, so the same number of drives. It was 4 before, it was 4 now, but 4 different ones. And with this change of dissipators, we believe that the only error source that we still have there is anomalous heating and ion traps. And that means that you should be able to drive down your error as much as you want if you just have enough power. So in that case, what the outcome of the control solution is, if you plot the error as a function of the power on a logarithmic scale, you got something that is roughly linear. And we could read off what is the power needed to really hit the error correction threshold. Okay, so this is the type of problems that we have been looking at. Let me finish with one set of summaries of, I would say, preliminary rules for the control of open quantum system as a general take-home message. And this, the word preliminary already implies that these are not meant to be exhaustive, but I think they capture pretty well the current state of the art. So first of all, the environment can be detrimental. And that is in particular the case if you have undesired Markovian dynamics. So some unwanted defacing mechanism or some unwanted T1 decay. And then the only strategy that we have found so far is beat it by being fast. You cannot exploit the environment in that case. So do things as fast as you can. You also have the beneficial case of desired Markovian evolution, like in laser cooling. And then what you have to make sure is that the target is the fixed state of your evolution. Or must be fixed state of the, not of the evolution, of the generator. The steady state. Target state must be the steady state of your evolution. And that, of course, is what has been used already in quantum reservoir engineering, and you can improve upon it with optimal control. And for non-Markovian dynamics, so we have a few examples that can be both beneficial or detrimental. And it's, I think, in general, not clear when which case enters. I can give you one example when it's beneficial, and I think that intuitively also is not so surprising. If you have strongly coupled modes in your environment, which themselves are sufficiently isolated. Then you can use them for control. Because what happens is that you can use them effectively as if they were ancillas, ancilla systems. But they still can be real environmental effects. So for example, in superconducting qubits, you have dielectric defects, which you can very well describe as a two-level system, and you can even characterize them. And you can use the coupling to these two-level defects to get operators which in your Hamiltonian may be missing. And for example, implement operations that with just the system alone you cannot implement. Similarly, in envy centers, you have a natural spin bath, and some of these spins may be sufficiently longly lived. And then the same idea applies. So I would say this one case of beneficial non-Markovian dynamics is clear, but if there exist also other ones, that's one of the open questions. Okay, and I would say in general, our understanding of control and controllability for non-Markovian systems is fairly limited. And maybe that's a good news, at least for this program, there's a lot of things to be done. Thank you for your patience. Since you're not walking out yet, I mean, if there are more questions, we can, of course, continue, or we can continue in one-on-one discussions.
Well, we do need to do announcements. I just want to make sure people don't leave. But can we have a few minutes for questions? Is that okay with everyone? So, because the three, you know, rows is really bothering me. So, I mean, I sort of buy this, you know, if you're working on one qubit or maybe two qubits, you know, but those are like exactly solvable kind of problems, right? But, you know, is that the case? I mean, if I hand you, you know, 10 qubits, can you identify
you prove
your three
it for, You prove it for an N-level system.
Yeah, but just because you've proven it doesn't mean you can find the rows. So, can you, what is the computational difficulty?
Okay, so that's exactly a good point, and that relates to what Andrew was saying. So, in principle, these three states are sufficient, but in this one state, here, in this one, I put a lot of information.
Yeah.
Okay. So the numerically more efficient way of using this function is actually not to use three states, but use n plus one, and have these separate. Have here a set of bases where each of them is a projector. So that, in our numerical studies, turned out to be the most efficient version. But in terms of a yes-no question, this is sufficient.
You still need the size of the Hilbert space.
So I guess if there would be a clear recipe to find these states with minimum lattice, then this solution would also have practical relevance.
Right.
But otherwise, it's a more theoretical, fundamental.
No, but this is a constructive prescription. I mean, this state does the job.
But you need to know all of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You need to be able to diagonalize all the corresponding operators in order to get your projectors.
So. If you do that...
But the projectors are just projectors in my Hilbert space. It's just a complete basis.
Oh, so arbitrary basis.
Orthonormal, yes.
Right.
So a well-defined basis, but any...
So I could use the Fock basis in my many-body problem, and I'm done. I do have to sequence over that basis, but I don't have to find new combinations of basis elements. You don't have to diagonalize them. So it's n, not n squared. But you had to diagonalize it in n squared, but you know now it's still n, right? So you're still limited to 28 qubits or whatever you can do on your my laptop does 28 as it happens, but maybe yours does.
You have a nice laptop. I think that Jülich has now 40 or 42, but that's the absolute maximum. Yes. Stefan.
I would be interested, for example, in this example of where you found the faster set of universal gates. Mm-hmm. For the transport qubits, and you said that the solution was a new method, or a new, I'm not sure if I fully understood it, but
a new parameter regime. So when people fabricate these superconducting qubits, they have quite a bit of choice in the design parameters.
Okay.
And by that I mean the frequencies of the qubits, of the cavity, and the couplings between them.
Okay, but it was not a new type of gate that was discovered, or a clever way of using decoherent-free subspaces, or that came out of this method that could trigger, say, okay. We could have thought about this without the method, and that your method was basically a vehicle of bringing us to a new concept that made these things faster. How often does this out of these?
What we found... In this example, so this refers just to the choice of the design parameters.
Okay.
And then for the gates, we found that the natural gate for the superconducting qubits is the square root of swap gate. Because you can optimize for an arbitrary perfect entangler, and then you reduce the time, and you see which one survives. So if you start with a long time, then you get almost any arbitrary perfect entangler. If you reduce it, then you get only a few, and if you reduce it even more, then a single gate survives that you can still implement with high fidelity. And that turned out to be the square root of swap gate. So we identified that, the natural gate for this architecture is the square root of swap gate.
Is that intuitively clear as well?
To the they were not overly surprised, let's say, but they still thought it was nice that one could actually show that. So nobody had proven this before.
I have one more quick comment, unless there's a question. Yeah.
I was just wondering where the following might fit in. So there are ideas which use sort of coherent feedback control, where in a sense you take some output and then bring it back in some time delay, so it ends up with a non-Markovian sort of engineered reservoir to or something. How would you fit that in?
Well, that's why I put my disclaimer in the beginning. I'm not looking at feedback at all. So, because it really requires a different set of tools. That's why I think it's... Also, the communities are really distinct. But yes, of course, it's a completely legitimate way of doing things and interesting. It's just not something that I'm very knowledgeable about.
I'm always suspicious of completeness, even though I love it mathematically. You probably don't need all N projectors to get a mostly good answer. Is there an optimization procedure in terms of, getting 90% of your target overlap with your target state, or 99%, or some fidelity overlap with your target state, and then you don't need as many of these?
I would intuitively say for specific problems, most likely so. But this is a general mathematical proof. So I think then you need to exploit certain properties of your system in order to say, well, I'm only interested in certain regions of Hilbert space.
Christina, thank you very much again for being here.